This is Viewpoint with attorney and author Chuck Crismeyer. Viewpoint is a one-hour talk show confronting the issues of America's heart and home. And now with today's edition of Viewpoint, here is Chuck Crismeyer.
Have you ever noticed how words matter? They really do. Words can change the world. They can destroy the world. Words matter. It has often been said as we were growing up, or many of us were growing up, that sticks and stones can break my bones, but words will never hurt me. Not true. Just not true. Words have creative power. They're like seed bags. And if you were to read the Bible, you would discover, in fact, that that's exactly how Jesus saw the words of God. In fact, his words are described as words that contain content that produce after their kind. The Bible is therefore a seedbag of words. Words to be used or not to be used. To be used in a proper way, to be planted in a certain way or not. And in fact, it was Jesus himself, the one who rose from the dead, who said, "By your words you will be justified, and by your words you will be condemned." So here's the question that I have for us today here on Viewpoint, since 95-98% of our listeners are professing Christians. What are your words saying? Are your words, by your words you will be justified, by your words you will be condemned? So how are things going with regard to your words? As you use your words with regard to your family, your words with regard to your spouse, your words with regard to those that you work with, your neighbors. And how about in our political dialogue? How about the words? Have you noticed, if you've been listening to this program long, you notice that we do not use traditional labeling words. Never have. For the very launch of this program, 29 years ago, May 5th, 1995, we have not used the labeling words that most people use in political discourse or in any other kind of discourse. We try to use words that describe, not words that label. And there's a difference, because labels become, as it were, libels. In fact, we actually distort our communication by using labels when we think actually that we're distilling our communication and making it more easily transmissible. But in actual fact, we're actually deceiving ourselves and those around us. And as our guest today, we become agents of the very division that we deplore. So here on Viewpoint today, we're going to be talking about the power of words, but we're also going to be looking at it perhaps in a little different way than you might have thought, may have considered, because words are very important. One has said, be careful with your words. Once they're said, they can only be forgiven, not forgotten. So when we speak things out there in the political world, in our discussions with regard to various elections and various issues and so on, someone else has said, our words are more powerful than an atom bomb. Wow. Well, that's taking it out there quite a ways. That's a long stretch, but words are very powerful. And that's why, believe it or not, the Bible says that the Bible is the word of God, sharper than even a two-edged sword, can discern even between the thoughts and the intents of the heart. Wow. Now that's some kind of word, isn't it? Well, today we're going to take a look at all of this issue of words and our conversations and how it relates to our country and whether or not our country can actually survive the barrage of labeling words. Our special guest today, Brent Hamacek, with his book, Dissidently Speaking, not differently speaking, but dissidently speaking. He says, we got to change the words and change the war of words. Brent, it's good to have you on the program.
It's terrific to be here. And that opening you just gave, I got to tell you, I'm lucky to do a number of different interviews in different formats. That was probably the best lead in to my being able to be a guest on someone's show I have ever heard.
Whoa.
So I am looking forward to this.
Well, those words certainly are encouraging to yours truly. We've been doing this a very long time, and when the Lord called me to leave the practice of law at the height of my career, saying, brother, you've been, son, you've been proclaiming, pleading the cause of men long enough. I want you to plead my cause in the land as a voice to the church, declaring vision for the nation here in America's greatest crisis hour. I realized what we did here had to be different than what others were doing in the way they were doing it. And there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of radio and television programs out there with issues oriented. I've been on many of them. And the problem is, it's almost as if they live in an echo chamber, and they're all using, or most of them are using, the same labeling words that end up being this team against that team, right against left, labels against, and that become libels, and so there's no place for conversation. Is that how you see it?
Well, it's not just how I see it, it's how I wrote it. And, you know, a few things. One of the things you said in your intro was about how words can be more powerful than atomic bombs. You know, there's an old expression that says ideas precede weapons.
Mm-hmm.
And that's so very true, right? No war is ever started without rhetoric in advance of it. And so language and words are extraordinarily powerful.
Well, they are. When Ronald Reagan stood there at the wall dividing East and West Germany, he said, Mr. Gorbachev, tear this wall down. He wasn't being mean to Mikhail Gorbachev. In fact, they actually had quite an interesting conversational relationship. But he spoke clear words. They weren't labeling words, but they were clear words. And it seems to me that in this day and age, we have a very hard time speaking clear words that cannot be misconstrued.
Well, you're correct. And, you know, you talked about the right-left thing. And in the book, I spend the entire first chapter proving, and I use the word proving quite deliberately, simple word, specific meaning, but proving to people that these terms right and left that we use today actually have no objective meaning. In fact, they not only don't mean the same thing to any two people,
mm-hmm.
they don't mean the same thing to the same person all the time.
That's
and
true.
What they are simple pejoratives that we use to describe others with whom we don't agree.
In other words, they're labels.
They are labels. You know, fun story, if somebody Googles the Hamacek family name, they'll find out that my ancestors were involved in the invention of the pea binding machine. And
okay.
my father, who was born in 1912 and as a young boy worked in a pea canning factory, told the story of how they'd be running the line and canning the peas, and they would stop the line because they would change the label on the can, and the label would change from, you know, Joe's Peas to Joe's Premium Peas, and then they'd start the line again, right? They were the same peas, and so we can label things any way we want to label them, but it doesn't help us get at the truth of what they actually are.
Exactly.
And I think the right-left labels in this country are two of the most destructive words that we have ever put to work, and they are one syllable each. They're seemingly clear. Everybody knows the difference between right and left, and yet they don't.
That's
and,
true.
It's very
that's true.
The problem.
You give a little history lesson concerning how mm-hmm. that terminology actually developed, and we've talked a great deal on this program concerning the French Revolution, actually is sort of a metaphorical type of the end times from a biblical perspective. What happened there with the, first of all, the terror and then the great terror is very much akin to what Jesus described as the place of tribulation as we approach the second coming of Christ, followed by the great tribulation. So we have a lot of similarity there, but tell us how the French Revolution brought about the terms left and right real quickly.
Well, very, very simply, they had the National Assembly convened, and on the right side of the room were those loyal to the monarchy and, you know, the members of the first and second estate, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And on the left-hand side of the room were those that we could call the proletariat, more if we want to move forward 100-plus years.
Mm-hmm.
But they were the actual citizens, right? Mm-hmm. The members of the masses, the third estate. And so in that arrangement, for having those folks on the left and then supporters of the monarchy on the right, came to us from the way French seating was done at formal dinners,
mm-hmm,
with your distinguished guests on the right. And this is where it started. And so it was the right wing of the assembly hall and the left wing of the assembly hall. And from that, we have been trying to construct models of social behavior ever since, determined to put it at a French dinner table. And it simply doesn't fit.
Well, even the French couldn't figure it out. They sent a fellow by the name of Alexis de Tocqueville over here in 1830 to try to figure out why the French weren't working it out. They couldn't get a stable government, even though they had had a revolution, and they were supposedly pursuing liberty, equality, fraternity, and they had neither of those. And he wanted to find out what it was that made America great. So he comes over here and he studies for 9 months. That should give birth to something, which indeed it did, the book Democracy in America. And he said in there, you know, I came to this country and I saw all the amazing harbors and the natural resources and all the vast beauty and the ingenuity of the people. But he said, it was not until I went into the churches of America and heard her pulpits aflame with righteousness that I understood the secret of her genius and power. So he said, America's good, great, because America's good. And if America ever ceases to be good, America will cease to be great. He didn't use any of that left-right terminology, did he?
No, he didn't. And, you know, and de Tocqueville's quoted in the book, ironically or interestingly enough, or perhaps not so ironically. But look, the American experiment, as it's called, I really think can be more likened, instead of an experiment, which has set terms, a certain duration, controlled variables, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
I liken it more to what I'm very familiar with in my career, which is a new business startup. And so what was the American, this new business selling? Well, it was selling individual liberty,
mm-hmm,
under a natural law model,
right,
as designed by sort of there were many contributors to the invention.
Mm-hmm.
But let's give the patent to John Locke. And because it was really Locke who probably had the greatest influence on what they built. And they said, all right, so we're going to sell natural law freedom to people. Let's see how they consume it. And one of the things I do in the book at great length is sort of say, look, we're still in business. I just wrote, you know, filled out my tax return. So I know we're still in business.
Or at least it appears to be that way.
right. Well, and like all companies, they tend to be unrecognizable from their start. You know, if they very few last a century, of course, let alone over two. But what do we look like, you know, a couple hundred plus years in? And what have we learned about a consumer base that has an opportunity to sort of gorge itself on the idea of natural law? And I think we've learned a great many things that, are interesting. They're certainly not all positive.
Right.
Not at all. And
that's because they're invested and carried out by something called human nature, which the Bible refers to as of the flesh. And our founders, while not using that term, knew that human nature was not to be trusted. And that's why they didn't give us a pure democracy, because they knew a government ruled exclusively by the feelings of the people would become the greatest tyrant ever to rule the world. And so they gave us a republic, as Franklin said, if you can keep it. And of course, the big operative word there is if, isn't it?
It is. And you know, I think one of the things that people really need to you know, sort of stew upon a bit, if you will, with regard to this idea of a free nation embracing natural law and minimal government that, you know, only protects life, liberty, and property, right? What they need to think about is this, and I've had some wonderful conversations over time with my dear friend Dave Shistokas, who's a constitutional expert, and has written extensively on it. And he believes, truly, it's man's nature to be free. I would take issue with that, and I would suggest that over 3,000 years of history proves otherwise.
It's man's nature to dominate everybody else for his own service.
That's exactly right, and so here's what's miraculous about what the Founding Fathers did. It's not that they gave us a system that allowed us to embrace our nature. It's that they gave us a system that allowed us the opportunity to potentially control the worst elements of our nature.
Exactly.
While then still being able to be free. But as I like to say, put a madman in a concrete walled cell and give him a really good spoon and an infinite amount of time, and eventually he'll dig through the walls. And what we've managed to do now, 200 plus years in, is you can see we're digging through the wall.
Yeah.
And our nature is escaping from the constraints which they built to contain it.
Exactly. That is well spoken. And friends, we're going to be heading into a break here shortly, but Brent Hamacek, I think you can understand, has given a great deal of thought to where we are as a nation, as a people. His book is called Dissidently Speaking, and we'll be talking a little bit more about what he means by that. Changing our words that will change the war, the way that we wage this war to try to protect and restore not only freedom and liberty, but a nation under God. And that was, in fact, you know, the motto that came from the bridge that was just destroyed. Well, not it didn't come from the bridge. It came from Francis Scott Key, a godly lawyer, who actually penned our national anthem. And the bridge was named after him, the Francis Scott Key Bridge. And he actually wrote or penned the national anthem out there in Baltimore Harbor, even as the British were pounding away at the country. And the second stanza of that national anthem, oh, thus be it ere when free men shall stand between their loved homes and the war's desolation. Blessed with victory and peace, may the heaven rescue land praise the power that hath made and preserved us a nation. Then conquer we must when our cause it is just, and this be our motto, in God is our trust. Then the star-spangled banner in triumph shall wave o'er the land of the free and the home of the brave. Notice the word then. You see, there are predicates for our success as a country. A nation under God, and then we conform our hearts, our words, our ways in that alignment, and then we have hope for the future. And I think that's where our friend Brent Hamacek is speaking here in his book, Dissonantly Speaking. $20 will put it in your hands. It's on our website, saveus.org, saveus.org. You can give us a call at 1-800-SAVE-USA. That's 1-800-SAVE-USA. Or you can write to us at Save America Ministries, P.O. Box 70879, Richmond, Virginia, 23255. You're writing a check at $5 for postage handling. Do it today. Don't delay. And I think you're going to find his book to be fascinating. In fact, he says, if we could just flip two words in the English language and have people stop saying it is and instead ask, is it, we might just go a lot further in our conversations. Tell us a bit about that, Brent.
Well, I think we've gotten ourselves stuck in the declarative and we've lost our way with regard to the interrogative. And we live in a time where people are very quick to tell you how things are and what they know and why they're just quite certain of it. And we've lost our way in terms of them asking questions of others to mm-hmm. understand where it is they're coming from. And we've also lost our way in terms of asking ourselves questions to check our own premises.
In other words, we're not willing to really define the terms of our conversation.
We're not willing to define them, and we're not willing to let others define their own to us.
Mm.
I mean, we there's an entire chapter in the book that's devoted to what has broken down in terms of personal communication.
Right.
So what's gone wrong in our engagements between us and them, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the biggest problems with that is, you know, I like to make the point that I think the two most influential figures that have ever lived in human history, one on the secular side and one on the religious side, are Socrates and Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
They have two things in common. One is they both died for their activism, and the other is they changed the course of history by asking questions. And so we need to be not so quick in trying to tell people about those things which we are certain, and we need to start asking them what they think about it, and we need to ask ourselves, are we really right to be that certain? And so flipping those two words is powerful stuff.
All right. I agree with that in terms of conversation, but underlying that, there's a danger. I see. And that danger is the idea that, well, we can just compromise. We can just compromise on by asking the question, is it? Well, okay, you have your viewpoint, I have my viewpoint. How about if we just agree to disagree and go along to get along, or we compromise and there is no real pursuit of truth? Do you see that danger?
Well, yeah, because I do, but let me reframe it.
Okay.
So one of the things I point out in the chapter where I make the argument that we become addicted to confrontation,
mm-hmm,
is, you know, we like to talk about splitting the difference, or,
right,
you know, we see, let's meet halfway.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually use a fun personal example. I'm told I should tell more stories because I'm a good storyteller. So I tell one.
Okay.
And I use a group of high school buddies I've got. There's 13 of us from the class of 80 at Sioux Area High School in,
uh-huh,
Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan. And every year we get together somewhere. We're scattered all over the country, and we get together for a week.
Huh.
And we do not, in making that decision about where we meet, we don't pull out a map and I'm drawing a blank, a compass,
mm-hmm,
and start to find the equidistant point for all and go there. No,
okay.
What we start to do is say, who's got dates they can't travel? Who's going to be in a spot that won't let them get to where we want to be?
Mm.
Where's a place that we haven't gone to before? And so on. We're not trying to meet in some neutral middle point. We're trying to find a point to meet which works best for as many members of our group as we possibly can.
Well, that's a good thing when it comes to situations that don't have to do with absolute truth or what is actually true. But there are many things that have to do with what is actually true. And you can't deal the same way, can you?
Well, no. I mean, look, my objectivist background and it requires me to acknowledge that there are absolutes in truth. But, and this gets awfully, awfully complex. probably worth another, you know, full four segments.
That's
true.
But
I would suggest this to you, that those things that involve some form of absolute truth don't necessarily have a lot to do with getting along and living together day by day. So from an ethics standpoint, by the way, which would be fun to talk about here, there's a whole chapter in the book devoted to the idea of ethics and,
uh-huh,
having people question those structures. Now, I can control my own ethical behavior. I have full control over that.
At least you hope you do. You wish you did.
Well,
theoretically,
right,
so you do.
right, exactly. To the extent it's possible, I have control.
There you go.
But I have no control over the ethical behavior of others.
Exactly.
So do I give up? Do I suggest that there is no right ethical practice? No. What I do is recognize that while I may believe and feel and even know that there are absolutes in that sense, that I'm not going to be able to universally get everyone to acknowledge or agree to them, but I must live with them.
Mm-hmm.
So accommodating a difference, there's very few other absolutes that would actually interfere with being able to live a life that could be at least somewhat harmonious.
Unless someone else had beliefs that insisted upon your destruction, such as the fundamental rules of Islam that say Islam must rule the world and all those who oppose are infidels and must be destroyed. That's a whole different ballgame, isn't it?
Well, look, it is. I mean, we come down to that great, the Latin concept of the difference between malum in se and malum prohibitum.
Now you're starting to sound like a lawyer.
So, well, something evil in and of itself, or something evil simply because it's prohibited, right?
Yeah,
and,
there you go.
And I do think that most people have some sort of innate sense. I agree with Adam Smith that we have a sense of these things that we're born with, of those things that are evil in and of themselves. And but bear in mind, there's no universal agreement of it, but there's an example of where we should not abandon absolutes. So no one has to tell me under any ethical construct that it's wrong to harm a small infant child. But for somebody who sees that differently, I needn't tolerate that difference. I need to deal with that because that is evil in and of itself. And most all of humanity would recognize it.
Yeah. You know, you actually quote the words of Jesus Christ when he said to the lawyer, a religious lawyer that confronted him, what's the greatest commandment? And he said, quoting the Old Testament, actually, he said, well, the first is you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And the second is you should love your neighbors yourself. On these two hang all the other laws and commandments. In other words, this is the distillation from a lawyer's viewpoint. We used to have what we called summaries of the law or restatements of the law. And that was a summary restatement of all of God's viewpoint. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. Now, if we really did that, if that was really the operative truth in the life of every human being, or let's say every American, we would be on the near edge of Thomas More's utopia, wouldn't we?
Well, yeah, and I feel more and more like it wasn't me sitting at a keyboard, it was you, because the reference you just made is also in the book, and in pointing to that in the chapter that is about our addiction to confrontation, I think we would all do well to remember that particular teaching of Christ. I think many Christians would do well to remember that particular teaching.
Oh, really? In other words, you think it might actually change the tone or the rhetoric coming out of Christian activists?
I do. I have a great many concerns, and some of which I do share in the book about the what we could call this sort of Christian activist political movement.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it has been hijacked by people that stand on stage and tell you that they're prophets and tell you what Jesus would have you do and exactly what you need to do. And oh, and first, by the way, please write me a check. These things trouble me greatly. You know, I say in the book, and I say to people all the time, look, if you're a true Christian and you have that in your heart, you don't need people running around telling you what Jesus would have you do. You already know. And so
if you really have allowed his word or words to permeate your own heart. Otherwise, you're operating in a natural law abstract in which there's no restraints on you.
Well, correct. And, we like to think that from a Christian perspective, we have it sort of figured out, right? And so that's a good notion, and I do think that if we kind of stick to the ideas in the four Gospels, that's an awfully good roadmap. But then you say, so what goes wrong? Well, let's see. The Inquisition went wrong.
Oh, my.
Puritans get a lot of good press for building the country, and we've got the whole first Thanksgiving and all that stuff. The Puritans burned witches, and folks cheered.
Yep.
And we can't escape the fact that throughout all of Christianity's history, much harm has been done in Christ's name.
True.
And so this is where I get concerned about current day political movement, and that is not wanting to see yet another Salem, if you will.
Well, and, you know, it goes back to that phrase, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And the interesting thing about Christ and the Gospels and the message of the epistles and so on is not about political power. It's about personal humility and submission to the word, will, and ways of God. And the moment we adopt a power mode, that's when we, our flesh begins to corrupt, and power corrupts, and absolute power then corrupts absolutely, to the point where one serious writer actually referred to the Roman Catholic Church as the absolute monarchy. In other words, the absolute power to corrupt absolutely. So, and he was a Roman Catholic that wrote it. So there's enough problems to go around. And I wonder if we couldn't find a place in our own hearts and lives to keep it simple. As one person said, keep it simple, saints. KISS. Keep it simple, saints. The moment we try to impose upon the simplicity of it is the moment we start carrying on labels, and the labels become libels, and then we have engendered just tremendous division. And some are saying that we're more divided now as a country than we were at the Civil War. What say you?
Well, yeah, to the point, your message about, you know, keep it simple, a saint, I think the only thing worse than a despot is a despot who believes he's doing his work in God's name. And then God help all of us, right? Yeah, we're extraordinarily divided in this moment in time. People, you know, use the Civil War as sort of a metaphor, as sort of a historical example.
Mm-hmm.
I would suggest what was interesting about the Civil War was that at least in that case, we could see the lines of demarcation sort of between North and South.
Right.
Here the lines of demarcation are our dining room tables.
Well, that's right. And we have a political line of demarcation. It's called blue states and red states. And in reality, what I see, and you can correct me or make your modified thought, but when I look at the blue state and red state political description, what we're really talking about is the behaviors and beliefs that have flowed from people where the predominant weight of the people in those states are either God-fearing or not God-fearing.
Well, I do think in the chapter that I write on ethics, one of the things I think that helps people behave better, not be better, but behave better, is if they hold to some form of strict belief in either the Constitution, being an American, mm-hmm. that's what being an American means.
Mm-hmm.
It means you can't say, you know, I'm a really good American. I hate the Constitution, though.
Well, and that's what Barack Obama said, and he was elected president.
Right. So if you're a good American, you love the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
That is a written document objectively standing outside of yourself. Now, if you do the same thing with Scripture,
right,
and you say, I am a good God-fearing person, and I hold the Scripture. Okay. In either case, does it mean that you're necessarily going to behave better? It doesn't. But here's what it does do. Both of those become better angels on your shoulder. Constantly tapping you, and just when you want to do something that purely maximizes pleasure or minimizes pain, you stop for a second. You say, ugh, God, the Constitution thing and those ideas, I can't do it. Or you say, oh boy, that passage in Scripture, maybe I shouldn't do what I'm about to do.
Yeah, they're boundary lines
outside yourself.
Exactly. And that's what John Adams, our second president, said: our government was made for a moral and Christian people and is wholly inadequate to the government of any other. And Robert Winthrop said, We will either be governed by a power within or by a power without, either by the Bible or by the bayonet. So we were given a kind of government that recognized the frailty and the tendency of human nature to be other than godly and to be selfish. So we were given a republic to counterbalance human nature. And where's our battle now? Why is it that we are trying to get rid of? In fact, there's one aspect, one major division of our country that is trying to get rid of all the checks and balances. Why?
Well, look, I think that what we're sitting in now, you know, if you literally in this moment in time, in this instant, in this country,
right,
we are sitting in the most comfortable, opulent, rich setting that has existed in all of human history, not just in time, but in place.
Mm.
So 2024, United States of America.
In spite of all the talk about poverty and problems with the economy and so on.
All right. Well, and of course, the poor will always be with you, right?
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean that we've eradicated problems, but just look around.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, nothing has ever existed like this. So as I'm fond of saying, this is not Sparta. And what I believe happens is that once you become this comfortable, this civilized, you actually lose your need, perceived need, for engagement and closeness with others.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have it anymore. You can do just fine isolating with your smartphone, having your groceries delivered,
mm-hmm.
having your electric car drive you wherever you want without touching the steering wheel and so on.
Do you know that that's exactly what Alexis de Tocqueville warned this country about in his book, Democracy in America? He's the one that coined the term individualism. And he said it's one thing to have a nice focus on the individual and freedom, but taken to its extreme, it'll destroy your country.
Well, and that's another four-hour segment to really pull apart. Individualism.
Well, it sounds to me like you really are into these three or four-hour conversations. You that's where your mind and heart is, right?
Yes. I mean, I'm in some doctor's offices. I'm literally a prescription for others' sleep. But the notion of individualism isn't a problem in and of itself. I'd argue what is a problem is when the individualism allows us to start to view others as a means to an end.
Mm.
And I think that's the part that we've gotten to where now and we live under a bell curve. So this isn't universal. It's not everybody,
right?
But within a few standard deviations of the mean, a great many people, now in the comfort of their home with their smartphone and their food being delivered and all that other happy nonsense, it gets easier and easier to view others as a means to your own end.
Well, that's called selfishness. Don't we live in a selfie world? In fact, the Apostle Paul told us in his letter to Timothy that this is a precise description of the end times. He called them perilous times that would come. Men would be lovers of themselves. And then he began to describe exactly what that looks like. It was like he was drawing a portrait of American life right now.
Well, I'd make the Ayn Rand argument that selfishness properly understood is a virtue. And that is the idea that first and foremost, we have an obligation to take care of, sustain, and sort of actualize ourselves.
Well, that's true, because Jesus himself said that you should love others as you love yourself.
That's right.
Yeah.
And the key is in what I mentioned a moment ago. And it is selfishness turns from virtue to vice the moment we start to use others as a means to an end by which to satisfy our selfishness.
Now, isn't that exactly what's happening with regard to the improper use of law as a cudgel, as a weapon? for yeah. political power? Isn't that what we're looking at?
Yeah, I write something in the book where I say that I call it the paradox of law in a free society.
Mm-hmm.
And the paradox of law in a free society is that we need as many laws as possible to protect us from the acts of others, and we need as few laws as possible because we cannot trust those who write them or enforce them.
And this is
the paradox of law in a free society.
And that's the description of human nature from God's viewpoint.
Yes, and from empirical observation.
Exactly. And that's exactly what our founders did. In reality, our country, I think it's not quite accurate to say that our country was formed only on the Constitution. I think the Constitution flowed out of the earlier founding principles of biblical authority and the pursuit of loving God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and loving your neighbors yourself, which was, in fact, the Puritan and Pilgrim viewpoint, just not perfectly applied. And if you go to John Winthrop, a godly attorney that brought over four boatloads of Puritans in 1630, before he landed, he penned what some of the historians have said is the most important and accurate expression of the American vision ever penned. He called it a model of Christian charity. I have it as the appendix in my book, Renewing the Soul of America. And it's powerful. And he warned us like a prophet. He said, if we don't accept these principles, we're going to become a curse and a byword among the nations. And that's exactly where we are.
Well, and just to be clear, so your audience, in case I misspoke at all, when I refer to the Constitution and that defining you as, you know, an American, I do mean, you know, today. I mean, if you say, I love my country, what do you love?
I knew exactly what you meant.
What it is.
I'm glad you tried to make that explanation, but I knew exactly what you meant.
Yeah. And so in terms of the formation of the document, you know, it's interesting because a lot went into it. And a lot of and folks will take different sort of place different emphasis on, you know, different contributions to it.
Sure.
But I think that's interesting, too. So I place an emphasis on John Locke's influence. Well, so Locke's an interesting guy, right? He believed in God, but he was a deist and, you know, had that rational understanding of a God.
Mm-hmm.
And some of our founders were deists,
yes,
who actually evolved into that position, like Benjamin Franklin, for example.
Right.
So, but here's what we can say about God and Christianity in the founding of our country. By the time our country was founded, Christianity had been around for about 1,750 years.
Uh-huh.
And it had been pervasive throughout all of Western civilization.
Mm-hmm.
Every single thing that happened before our country was formed was impacted by Christianity.
Right.
So for anybody to say that Christianity didn't play a role in the formation of our country and how it was created is preposterous.
Yeah, you have to be blind in one eye and refuse to see out of the other.
Sure,
mm-hmm.
Exactly. So I like to stay away from, you know, is this a Christian nation or a secular nation or what? It is the nation that was created upon which a great many forces exerted influence, and Christianity was definitely one of them.
And that's the reason why the major effort today is to undermine all of that authority, all of the references to that history, and prepare the way for us to be absorbed into a new world order, a new global order, into the World Economic Forum or whatever, the Great Reset. That's the goal. It is to radically change what is here, because this is the final, as Abraham Lincoln said, the last best hope of Earth. You lose this and you've lost all other hope for the kind of freedom that the world has experienced since in the last 250 years or so. So we're in a moment of truth in the Valley of Decision, and I think that's kind of what you're saying in many respects in your book. We either get this together now, or just anticipate destruction shortly.
I couldn't agree with you more. And you know, the interesting way to look at it, you know, we look at the efforts of Elon Musk and others to go out and explore and colonize space. And well, and even going back to Star Trek in my youth, right? Space, the final frontier, the last thing for man to conquer. It isn't. The last thing for man to conquer is the globe. Man's inhabited the entirety of the globe, but it hasn't conquered it yet. And this is why understanding the types that are in the World Economic Forum and elsewhere is so important, because it's not about colonizing Mars. It is about colonizing the planet Earth and conquering that.
Under absolute dominion and control without the role of God and the salvation of Jesus Christ, so we become our own saviors and our own God, which was going to require some leader, some godless leader who will usurp power or be delegated power that will rule the world as an ultimate tyrant. And that's where things are heading, isn't it?
Well, it certainly is. I mean, this is, you know, we talked right at the beginning of your show about the danger of labels. And I couldn't agree more. And again, you told the story about the cans of peas. But doesn't mean that all labels and all words are meaningless.
No.
Here's one that matters, the notion or the term globalist. Because what that really means is something that has this Orwellian feel, right? But that idea then of colonizing the entirety of the earth, right? Conquering it, I should say. So globalization is a real thing. It's Hegelian, if you will. I mean, that's what Hegel said that we were ultimately marching towards. He said it was important to have nation states so that nation states could fight with each other, eliminate one, basically, I'm sort of simplifying it, and ultimately then we would get to just one nation state, right, worldwide. And so all of this, that has this sort of feeling in Hegel's mind of being inevitable, that we were going this way. But, of course, nothing is really inevitable. And certainly what we know is that man's ability to rule and govern effectively 8 billion people is non-existent. But that won't stop them from trying.
No, and they will, and they're already intent on doing that. I mean, even just, what was it, about 8-9 years ago, the former Prime Minister of Britain, Tony Blair, declared that he was forming the religious, whatever was the title, he went to New York and formed this religious organization to meld the religions of the world, which he said was the new politics and was necessary in order to achieve the new global order. So, I mean, the spirit of this is everywhere, and yet in America, we still have resident this idea that a nation state is important. God determined the nation states. He called for the nation state, and he reputed the idea of unifying all the nations of the earth. That's what Babel was all about in Genesis chapter 11. So here we are. History is trying to repeat itself, and the only thing we learn from history is we don't learn from history. Why is we don't learn from history?
Well, in part, it's anymore, you could argue, simply because we don't study it. There is a great myth that I address in the book, and that is the notion that history repeats itself. It doesn't. There's no pendulums. There's no cycles. What is constant is human behavior. If history repeated itself, we'd always know what was going to happen next, and we don't.
That's correct.
So we do live in a world of cause and effect, and human behavior is fairly constant. It looks like history repeats itself sometimes because we see the same kinds of things happening because of how humans behave. The humans do have a choice to behave differently. And part of what I'm trying to do in the book is to get people to think a bit, to think critically and behave skeptically, so that maybe what they think is history repeating itself will actually alter the trajectory that we're on right now.
And that involves our words. It involves how we communicate with one another. You know, I'm reminding of the words of Edmund Burke back there in not so jolly old England. He said, I can't do everything, but I can do something. What I can do, I should do, and by the grace of God, I will do. No man is an island, as John Donne said, but we do live in a world, we do live in among people, and we should do our best to live our life in accordance with what, and I'm going to say it right here, what God has said in his word. Either he's God or he isn't. Either Jesus Christ is Savior and Lord or he isn't. So decide. Decide and then live your life accordingly. But let's stop playing games. Let's stop using power games and power struggles and labels that become libels that only serve to divide. Let the truth divide. Let's not be agents of division. That's kind of what I gather from your book.
Very, very well said. And, you know, I think that, you know, we're, you know, I'm a recovery guy. And so I think we're craving conflict in this country in the same sort of way that I used to crave a glass of Jack Daniels.
Well, the conflict raises money. That's what it does. And it does, whether it's done in the name of right wing or left wing, it raises money. And
The conflict, you're right, it does. But, you know, there's a reason why you can't sell chocolate-covered steak in a restaurant. Nobody wants to buy it. And while the bartender might have been serving the Jack Daniels, I was the one buying it. He got rich, I got drunk. And if I hadn't wanted to get drunk, he wouldn't have gotten rich.
Well, so you can be your drunker, and I'm not going to do that because I haven't drunk a drop in my life. So it doesn't make me more righteous. It just makes me less of a drunkard.
good on you. But we have to, you know, very seriously, we have to, as a people, we can look at the people that are deliberately trying to divide us, and I talk about them in the book.
Right.
I mean, they're there. But we have got to stop blaming them. We have got to look in the mirror.
Yep.
We have got to own our percentage
of
the blame of what's going on. We have to. This isn't somebody else's fault. We are not victims here. We're volunteers. We've done this to ourselves over time.
Brent, I really appreciate your message in the book. And one of the things that I'm noticing, by the way, is that the technology is failing us. We have brushed by two what should have been breaks. We have not experienced them. I'm wondering what in the world is going on here. So I'm going to take a moment here and let people know again about your book, Dissidently Speaking. Not differently speaking, but dissidently speaking. Changing the words, change the war. We've got to come to grips with what we're doing, how we're doing it, why we're doing it. And hope lies in our individual willingness to do that. Words count. Jesus said our words count. By your words you will be justified. By your words we can be condemned. You go back to the Old Testament, the book of Proverbs, over and over again. It talks about our words. And they will bring life to those who find them and health to medicine to all their flesh. And they do count. Get a copy of the book, $20, Dissidently Speaking. It helps us to understand where we stand, friends. In the midst of the division, are we going to be agents of division or are we going to be agents of righteousness and truth and justice and genuine equality and goodwill for people as we attempt to lead them into the paths of what our Savior calls the truth. Dissidently Speaking, $20 on our website, saveus.org. Give us a call at 1-800-SAVE-USA, 1-800-SAVE-USA, or write to us at Save America Ministries, P.O. Box 70879, Richmond, Virginia, 23255. Writing a check at $5 for postage and handling. Again, I don't quite understand what's happened to our technology, and it runs by computer, and computers seem to be, well, we rely upon them, but they fail us from time to time, don't they, Brent?
Yes, the technology does fail, but we always have to remember that, at least till this point, with artificial intelligence still in its near infancy, most